Now I would like to introduce the main speaker for this evening, Joe C. from San Diego.
Hello, everybody. Joe Conroy, alcoholic. This is pretty cool. I'm up in the high-tech booth up here. You guys haven't seen it. It's pretty cool. I'm asking anonymity. It's the toughest word in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is pretty cool. I'm really glad I'm here tonight, and I hope you guys are too. I hope. Went to dinner with DZ Akins with my buddy Kevin, and it was really salty, and I'm just dying of thirst. It was unbelievable. And DeMond, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So it was good to hear you. I was born in Boston, as he already broke my anonymity there, but I was adopted by a family in Harlem, and I was... played basketball for years, you know. And then went to North Carolina on a scholarship. Yeah, don't I wish, man? I'll tell you what. I couldn't skate if I had no idea. First time I heard him say it, and he told us that he used to skate, I was like shocked, you know. When I was a kid, wasn't no black people on the ice at all. It was like what? but I really love being sober. I've had a really busy day. I actually was at the world famous Area Assembly for Area 8 today, and it was the delegates' report back. I was there all day. I'm the area archivist, so I have to go for that. And what that means, I have no idea. I was like historian or whatever. I just carry crap around and let everybody read it. And they tell me I don't do it right. And I say, I try. You know, I try the best I can. And they say, it's not good enough. And I go, I try anyway. So if you're new, I hope there's a whole bunch of newcomers here. I hope somebody talked to you outside or inside or somewhere. Somebody welcomes you back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because this is really a fun place to be. It really is. It's a place. I've been sober since January 1st of 1989. Took my last drink at New Year's Eve, 1988, New Year's Eve, a little bar in Hillcrest called the Number 1 Fifth Avenue. And I didn't know it was going to be my last drink at all. I didn't know that. I would have been a little more dramatic if I was. But it was my last drink. And I haven't had a drink since then. I've had many days that I've really wanted a drink and probably needed a drink. And somebody probably could even have bought me a drink, you know, but I haven't had a drink since then, and that's pretty cool. It's like, it's a moment in time for me, it really is, you know. If you're new, I can't think of his name now, the kid with 12 days that I used to know, you know, I knew him when he used to come to my meeting, and now he's got 12 days tonight. I'm really glad that you're here. Can't remember your name. Because it's really important for Alcoholics Anonymous to allow people to go out and come back. A lot of times we sit in Alcoholics Anonymous. I shouldn't say we. I have once in one judged people for drinking, you know, and going, you know, they're not really good alcoholics because they went out and got drunk, you know. You know, you don't belong here. You know, it's like my home group is the Fourth Dimension group on Wednesday night, and we did the third tradition. We didn't. Somebody else did the third tradition the other night. You did a really good job of explaining what it was like when Bill and the crew really started this deal, that they really only wanted pure alcoholics. You know, like just pure. I don't know what a pure alcoholic is. You know, but they only wanted people that drank, and they really had a tough time with people that got drunk, you know, but they let them come back. But over time, sometimes we judge people for a little bit for that, but I welcome you all here, you know. I welcome you new. There's a lot of people. I've met a couple of people earlier that the guy with the 10 years says, you know, just reach out. I'm afraid in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm afraid. People ask me, do you get nervous? I don't like doing this thing for virtue or whatever. I don't know what the hell it is, but I get nervous. Because I have to expose myself. I have to, there's a great pamphlet. I didn't do that on purpose. Wow. What? The what? The water? That's right. Oh, no, it's good. It's good. I'm burning up. I didn't say expose myself and to expose myself. I did I? I was like, I'll have to remember that the next time, though. That timing was perfect, you know. You know, there's a great pamphlet called The Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he talks about that there'll come a time when you strip yourself naked of all pretense and defense, and you learn how to trust the person that you're talking to, who's usually going to be your sponsor or your best AA friend. You're trusting that person with your secrets, you know, with your intimate secrets, you know. And a lot of them aren't that you killed somebody. You know, my secrets weren't that I killed them. Some of my biggest secrets were, like, I was afraid to return an overcooked steak. You know what I mean? I order it medium rare that comes out well done, and I just sit there and eat it. You know? Why wouldn't I say, hey, you know, this isn't done right. Could you just give me another? Oh, sure, no problem. You know, but I'm afraid. I'm afraid to return things to Costco. You know, so I won't go to Costco. You know, I won't buy anything. I'll go get a hot dog at Costco. That's about all I'll do. I'll tell you my hot dog story. Guy Kay, who's been the back there somewhere, years ago he went out and I said, come on, I want to take you to a meeting and I want to take you to dinner first. So we were going up to a meeting in San Marcos. It's a great meeting in San Marcos on Saturday night. It's a discussion and then a speaker. So we pull into Costco. And he goes, where are we going for dinner? I said, we're going to go right here to Costco for dinner. So we go in, and I come up to the counter. I said, can I have two hot dogs, please? And we get two hot dogs, and I said, this is $1.65, guy. This is the best dinner in town. And he was shocked, totally knew that this is it, the hot dog. So we go up to San Marcos, and they call on him as the 10-minute, not the 10-minute speaker, but one of the speakers that night, and he had to mention that in front of everybody. I was appalled. Still, I have no idea where I'm going with anything here. So anyway, oh my God, I heard that. So anyway, I've been sober since January 1st of 1989, and I really love being sober. It's really the best thing that's ever happened to me. In between this periods of times that there's been some awful stuff that's happened to me, and it's going to happen to you too. Nobody ever can guarantee that just because you put the plug in the jug and you came into AA and you got 100,000 commitments and you go to 100,000 meetings a day and you read all sorts of books and all sorts of literature that things ain't just going to happen. You know, you're not going to be able to balance your checkbook. You're probably not going to pay the rent once or twice a month. But all those things will happen to you. But the thing that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is the ability to tell somebody that this is going on in my life. That there's some, I'm not perfect. That I'm not perfect in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and you don't have to be perfect in here. There's one of the greatest books I've ever read in AA is called The Spirituality of Imperfection. And it talks about that imperfection is what people identify with. That seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. What I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now is what I'm going to try to do tonight. If I stick to that formula, I can probably share with you what it was like drinking. My drinking was drinking. My bottom was my bottom. I don't have to have another bottom. I don't have to have another bottom. And a lot of times people in sobriety talk about having bottoms. Oh, I hit another bottom. Oh, I hit another bottom. Oh, I hit another bottom. I'll never forget my friend Ron Wynn years ago. I was talking to him. He passed away years ago, but I was talking about, I hit another bottom, Ron. I hit another bottom, Ron. And he said, Joe, you hit one bottom to get to AA. That's the one that keeps you here. Everything else from that point on, if you picture it as a bottom, you're going to think of it as a negative place. Physically negative, an emotionally negative, and a spiritually negative place. And he says, if you can picture it as a plateau, just put that in your mind. What's a plateau look like? I said, oh, it's like a long green field, you know, with buffaloes and birds and stuff. He says, picture that in your mind. It's a pleasant place. A bottom is a dark, deep hole, a cavern. And then when you think of that stuff, your mind takes you there, and everybody, you know, you're attracted to meetings that everybody has just hit another bottom. So all of a sudden you start going to meetings where everybody's like, psh, psh, I'd like to share, please. I'm bleeding over here, you know. You know, and all of a sudden they say, it's just a dark, dark place. But if you go to places that are actually positive, that have an outlook on life, even when the days are really dark, even when there's storm all around you, when it's brewing all around you, with it's like hurricanes and tornadoes roaring through your life, and people go, Jesus, isn't today great? You're going, ah, you know, it's like, no, no. But something happens when the people that have attracted me to Alcoholics Anonymous have been the people who have been struggling living sober. Not the ones that come in here, put the plug in the jug, and have tra-la-la sobriety. Skipping from meeting to meeting. Just like, oh, this is great! You know, it's like... But really, it's like, wow, I don't know how to, oh God, I can't, I, please, oh, Jesus Christ, Christ, what, oh man, wow, whoa, wow, did you hear that? Hear what? I'm living with my friend Charlie way in the back, but he's got a couple years more than me, and I remember one morning, Charlie had a busy head. Had a really busy head when we got sober. And it was a Sunday morning men's meeting down at Pathfinders. Charlie got up to the podium. Charlie's about this big, right? He gets up to the podium. He goes, my name's Charlie and I'm an alcoholic. And then he went, did you guys hear that? And it was weird. He goes, that was silence. And the whole room got it. Got it. You know, because when you're new, your head is so busy. It's so busy. Sitting in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous thinking, how are they going to call on me? When will they call on me? Why don't they call on me? You know what I mean? Busy. 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 You go to Starbucks to get a coffee, and there's 40 people in line, right? And you're looking at the people behind the counter, and you know that they've hired the dumbest people in the world, right? And you're sitting there, and you're angry, and it's slower and slower, and you're getting veins, and you're mad, and you're sweating. You're going to kill them when you get up there. I can't believe this has taken this long. And you get up there, and they go, hi, can I help you? And you go, I'm really not too sure. You know, it's like, then you become one of those people that have, like, held up the line. You know, it's like, no, I don't really know. It's like, you know, I think I'll have, no, I don't want that. I'll have the, what's the medium-sized cup? The grande, yeah, I'll have that. Not the latte. No, I don't want the latte. No, I want that other thing with the milk, the steam milk, you know. No, I don't want that either. Hurry up! And then the other people behind you are doing the same thing. And then you go to a meeting and you start talking about it. And everybody starts laughing. And all my fears start going away. When I tell you I'm riddled with fear, it's 100,000 forms of fear and self-delusion. 100,000 forms of fear and self-delusion. My first sponsor, Eugene, when I told him that I was riddled with fear, there was like, and fear at Christmas and all this stuff. Christmas is an awful time for me. It's just, it's awful because Irish Catholic, five brothers, no sisters, just middle kid, just not athletic, fat, pimples, just, I didn't get the genes, physical or emotional or spiritual, nothing, you know, it was just everything. My life, it was just, you've only knew. It was awful. It was just being me was just terrible. You know, it really was. It was just, and I'm telling Eugene about all the fear I have and how much I hate Christmas. And it's like, it was just, and I can't, and I, it's just, oh, he said, Jesus Christ, Joe, do you ever just like stop? What? Do you ever just stop? Just like, Eugene, it's Christmas and I need to go shopping. I don't have any money and everybody's happy and I'm miserable and it sucks and I don't like it. He says, why don't you go to Horton Plaza and just shop? I don't have any money, Eugene. He said, I didn't say buy. Just shop. Just window shop. Just look. Just show up. Just enjoy the music. Just enjoy Horton Plaza. Enjoy Christmas. Okay. 2 or 3 years sober, I don't know how old I was. And I remember going down to Horton Plaza, and it was pretty cool. You know, it was festive. And I was walking to Horton. Now, I get busy in the head. So I'm walking to Horton Plaza, and I had just bought a walk for my house, because I've been watching Yan Can Cook on TV, and he always cooks with a wok, and I figured I could get a wok. I had the wok, but I didn't have the utensils. Now, I'm kind of like a little bit of, you know, there's no sense in cooking with a wok if you don't have the utensils to cook with a wok, because even in the instructions, it tells you to use the wok utensils, right? And so I'm in Horton Plaza, and I decided to go to Williams of Sonoma. Uh-huh. Because I saw it's kind of like got gadgets, right? So I walk into Williams & Sonoma, and Williams & Sonoma at Christmas time, it's very cinnamony. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's prepared for the season, and there's music, and the people are very Christmassy, and it's got wonderful music, and it's like kind of zen-ish, you know. And Bing Bing comes in the door, you know. I'm like, and I see this display in the back of the room. And it's like a motif, a country and western motif display. And on the top of the display was this clay pots with Chinese utensils in them. The wok things. And I just reached for them and pulled it out. And the whole top of the display came crashing to the ground and all over the place. And I'm literally standing there with the wok things in my hands. And I'm like, and the woman came up to me, she's going to help me. And I was like, no, no, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. And I threw it down and I walked out, and I literally just like, it was petrifying. Didn't have cell phones back then. This is a long time ago. So I trudged to his house and bitched up a storm to Eugene about how he made me do that. And he brought it right in perspective. He brought it right into the moment for me. He says, did you get hurt? No. He said, well, it's okay. See, I have this ungrounded and unfounded fear that I'm kind of like the boogeyman, that the boogeyman is alive and well in my life. I have this ungrounded and unfounded fear that if I did this, this other stuff would happen. Therefore, there's no sense in me doing that, because if that happens, then I'm going to do this. And if I do that, that's going to be awful. So I can't do that. So I'll just not do anything. It's a perfectly justified, cogent reason to live in bondage of self and blame you. That's all I would ever do. All I would ever do. You know, I blamed my brothers for my inability to play hockey, to bounce a basketball, to throw a football. They could very well. I couldn't. I'll never forget when I showed up at high school. My brother Brian was the captain of the football team, captain of the track team, captain of the basketball team, right? Stud. And then I showed up. He was a senior, and I showed up as a freshman. And they said, there's another Conroy coming? This is going to be a dynasty, right? And I remember trying out for football. I didn't even know how to put a cup on, for Christ's sakes, you know. But I remember trying out for football, and you know, they have these sleds. Have you seen they have these sleds that these guys hit, and they're usually gargantuan people hitting these sleds. And I just figured it was easy to do; it's no problem. You know, the coach is on the top, you know, and I'm a Conroy, I'm a star, super. My brothers, I'm like, wait, they're blazing the trail for Joe, and he's going to come in, and he shows up, and I show up, and the pads are like this, and I. And they told me I had to hit the sled and then spin and go hit the other one and spin and go hit the other one and you're gone. Well, I hit that goddamn sled about 100 miles an hour. I had no idea it was spring-loaded. I hit that thing, bam, and I went flying back straight to the floor. I went 100 yards backwards, and the coaches are going. My brother Brian goes, I didn't tell you guys that he's going to be a superstar. And those are the memories I have. Those are the memories I have of like not fitting in. Not fitting in, not doing anything, you know, not being able to do anything. And what happened was I was able to develop a wit and a cunning tongue and a vicious, nasty attitude. That if I saw a flaw in you, I picked on your flaw before you saw mine. And I could do it really well. Really, really well. And I went on to 10 Bar in Boston for years. And that's the best thing for a bartender to have, like, especially one who's scared to death of the world. I was scared to death of the world. And you put a big piece of wood in front of me and doors on each end that you can't get at me. I'm protected. And I'm a tough guy. And I'm a mean guy. And I'm a son of a gun behind the bar. But boy, when I wasn't behind that bar, I was scared. Sometimes I'd be walking around the city of Boston thinking that I just saw somebody that I 86'd from the bar. Oh my God, what is he going to do? He's going to recognize me. Oh my God, I can't. I got to get out. This is crazy. I would literally be walking around thinking that people that I had shut off from my bar were looking at me, and they're going to get me. That's the way I lived for a long time. And then when I got sober, Did that all go away? No, I had to have to tell you it didn't, you know. I started going to meetings right away up in Long Beach. I got to tell you what, 10 minutes to 9, you're going to give me the 10-minute sign. Got it? I started going to meetings up in Long Beach. So what happened was I was working in a comedy club in Boston. It was a guy that was he was sober 8 years in sobriety. He owned the club. He didn't own the bar. He owned the comedy club. I'm not going to try to explain that crap. But he owned the club, and he was sober 8 years sober. Now that's a really weird thing for somebody who hadn't admitted to my innermost self that I had a problem with alcohol yet. And I have to stress that point. If you're in here tonight and you haven't really admitted to yourself that you're alcoholic, it's okay. It's really okay, because I wasn't there yet. And these guys were sober. The Dick was a sober guy, and then all these comedians that worked for him were sober. And I tended bar for years, and I understood what a drunk was. I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was about, but I didn't know what it was. And these guys were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It scared me. It really, really scared me, because they were attractive. It was really, in a really weird way, and kind of this, like, I wish you would get out of my life kind of way, if that makes sense, you know? Because sober people kind of go like this. I'm walking behind the bar, like, I'm sweating right now, and I'd be always sweating behind them, and they'd be going, how you doing, Joe? I'm fine. You know? And you look at them like, why are you looking at me like that? You know, like, everything okay? You know, because, you know, it's like, it's really weird. And I would, like, get a little aggravated at them. And I remember this one night, I came up and I said, you guys are sober, right? What's that mean? And they told me, like, that they go to meetings and they don't drink and they don't, they went into this, what I heard was a tirade. They probably just said, we don't drink and go to meetings. But it's like, you know, I'm kind of like on the defensive, right? And it used to irritate me. Because they would sit there with this attractive look. I'm looking at the drunks down here that are screaming for alcohol, and these guys down here that are sipping tea, right, at a bar, which is not cool, in the city of Boston, as they say, right? So, but there was something that I wanted to continue to, because it was like, this is in 1988. I had a bad couple of years. Nothing's really working too well. I'm living in a three-room cold water flat in the north end of Boston, which is an Italian neighborhood. And no, I'm not saying that it's a bad thing, you know. I'm just not Italian. So I, everywhere I am, I don't fit. You know what I'm saying? And not only was it an Italian neighborhood, but it had just gone through a FBI mafia sting, right? So everybody that looked like me in the Italian neighborhood was law. Right? Irish Catholic, FBI, shitty of Boston cops. You know, so they thought I was the law, you know, and I'm just a drunk. And I'm living in this cold water flat. And I'm just, cold water means it's like no heat, right? It's just, it had a heater in the stove. And like I could never get warm, you know, but it was cheap, right? This is the way I think. It's cheap, you know. And I'm like miserable. And I would go down to Martinelli's and get a bottle of red wine. But I wouldn't get one with a cork. I'd get the one with the cork because I didn't want to get the cap. Because drunks drink out of caps. Do you know what I'm saying? So I'd get the cork. And I didn't have a corkscrew. So I'd push the cork into the bottle all the time. Right? See? So because I wasn't going to buy a corkscrew. That doesn't make sense. God's honest truth. So then I would sit in my house, drinking a bottle of red wine, and I would get a wine goblet too, you know, because the wine goblet is sexy, right? And then I would always listen to Willie Nelson. I was really big into Willie Nelson then. He was coming out with this like torch song crap, you know, like. I forget what it was, but it was just like, I would sit there and I'd be drinking the red wine and I would roll a joint, right? And then I would listen to this Willie Nelson, redheaded stranger from Blue Rock, Montana, you know. I'm redheaded and I'm strange and it was just, I'm all alone. So then I'd pick up the phone and I'd dial my brother who lives up in Santa Barbara and Jerry, how you doing? Good, Joe, how you doing? My life is miserable. What's going on? Nothing. You know, and he would kind of like ask these probing questions, you know. Like, what are you doing? I'm just sitting here drinking a bottle of wine. Who are you with? Nobody. Who are you listening to? Willie? You know. And he would say, can you do me a favor? Can you put the plug in the jug and go out? Just go out. Just be around some people. All right. And I would go out and just, I would start drinking. Oh, it was just awful. It was wonderful, but it was awful, you know, because Boston's a great place to drink. So I'd leave my house cold and I'd go out drinking. Drunk already. I'm drunk. I'm the type of person that had to get drunk to go out to get drunk. Yeah. You know, it's like, wow, I'm going to get drunk and then go get drunk. You know, and it was, you know, I would go from one end of the city, I'd go from my house, I would make it as far as the Puerto Rican neighborhood, and then I would have a couple of cocktails, and I liked going to the Puerto Rican neighborhoods because they would leave me alone, literally. I don't like people, and I used to love doing that, because I would go to these places, and they would just leave me alone, and I'm a bartender, so bartenders leave stupidly, astronomically bad lots of money tips, you know. So they would leave me alone, but they knew they were going to get some juice at the end of the night. And then I would leave, and I would walk back home, maybe take a cab, maybe take a bus, maybe take the subway, maybe. I would get home 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, walk into my house, and it's just miserable. I'd walk into this house, and it was riddled with cockroaches, and I'm telling you this because it was a really sad existence. And these guys at the end of the bar, the sober guys, I would go, what are you talking about being sober? What is this about? So they would try to tell me their little story. And I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear their story. I don't want that. I want a solution to my problem. And if it has to go through you, I don't want that. That doesn't make sense to me. Why would I have to listen to your crap so I could get sober? It doesn't make sense to me. Now, I'm not saying any of this, right? I'm thinking it really good, you know, and we're thinking it. We think, you know, it's like, I don't want to eat, you know, and then they start talking. It's like, holy Christ, you know, and it would go on and on and on and on. And I just wanted to get away. But one night, there was one night that I was done. And I said to Dick, the guy that ran the club, that I had a problem. I said the words, I have a problem with alcohol. I need some help. Did I say those words? I'm not too sure. But if you haven't said those three words will probably save your life. I need help. No matter what the problem is, if you say those words, that surrender is a really, really, really big deal for getting a solution to the problem. And this night I said to Dick, I need help, or I have a problem, I need help or something. But over time now, it didn't happen. He gave me his phone number. I didn't call him. I didn't do any of that crap. I didn't see him anywhere. I just ran. I was like, I had a problem that moment, that second in time I had a problem. He didn't give me a solution. He's a piece of crap. I'm never going to talk to the man again as long as I live. It's really the way my head went. But over time I ran into him again, and he actually asked me, how am I doing with that problem? And I didn't know what to say then, you know, because I'm a very good evader. I'm a very good evader. I can evade you like the plague. You can't see me. You won't see me. And it was done, because it was like once that ball is set in motion, once that play is started, especially when you've said I'm done, and he made it really attractive to me. So attractive that I had to move to California. That's really what happened. He made it so attractive that I had to pack my bags and get out here to California. And I did that in 1988, and I was so grateful for that. I thought I was going to come out here and be discovered. I don't know what I was. I had no idea. It was like something was going to be different. You know, it's like, boy, if I go there, things will be different. You know, things will be very different out there. And they weren't any different out here than they were back there. The only thing was that I was so alone. I think it's exactly the desperation you talked about, Damon. I was so alone. My desperation was so apparent that I had no idea what to do. I had none what to do. This guy Dick said to me once, he said, Joe, there'll come a time when you're done. And if you ask God for help, you'll never have to take another drink as long as you live. He said those words to me. I've never forgotten them. And it's the exact truth. It's exactly the way it happened. It didn't happen on New Year's Eve in 1988. It happened on New Year's Day, 1989. New Year's Day, 1989, I got a little flop house downtown at 7th and G downtown. And I was done. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, and I realized I was done. And I said, my God, I am an alcoholic. I actually said the words, wrote it in a stupid journal that I was keeping at the same time. And then I said, I need help. Wrote the words down, I need help. Now, was there any wind blowing through the windows, through my gullet? Nothing. It's a little flop house down at 7th and G, and I knew that something was very different. Absolutely knew something was very different. And from that moment to this, it's been Milton Merrill Edward Joseph Guybison. I'm going back to my Christmas story again. Milton Merrill Edward Joseph Guybison, if many people know him, passed away years ago. He helped start the South Bay Pioneers. Every dang time this guy would get up and speak, he would say, it says in the 12th step, in the 12 and 12, that joy of living is our code. But action is the key word. It used to make me cringe when he said that. Made me cringe when he said, the joy of living is our code. Why? Because I hate Christmas, right? Christmas, the word joy, is associated with Christmas. So every time he would say that, I would not listen to it. And he would say that, and then he would go on with the solution. And if you're anything like me, if you hear something you don't like, you turn everything else off. And you don't hear it. You just don't hear it. You just don't hear it. It's like, I can't think of the guy's name. Years ago, he was up in L.A. He used to say, if you can hang around AA long enough to listen to the music until you can understand what the words are all about. And I love that guy. He was from Orange County, and he'd say, listen to the music until you can understand what the words were. And then he would go on and talk about, if you go to a meeting, there's a beat in every meeting that's very different. There's a rhythm that's very different. There's a song that's very different. And if you can get into that beat and get into that rhythm, you'll find the beat that keeps you coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't all work for everybody. They don't all work for everybody. You know? And I was, for the years, I would go to a meeting, and I'd tell them, these meetings suck. I would badmouth them, and they're just awful. And then the rooms are full. The rooms are full, and I'm just not getting it. I'm not understanding. So I'm like, I want to get angry at them because I'm not hearing it. I'm not getting it because I don't have that receiver. You know, I'm not on that channel or what it is. I'm not in that moment. So I would like, then Eugene would say to me, will you stop judging? I'm not judging. Yeah, you are. Yeah, you are. Stop judging. And if you can do that, you'll see how your life gets really kind of full. Because I'd wake up in the morning. If you're like me, wake up judging. Wake up thinking about yesterday, thinking about them, thinking about what they should have, my family. Oh, Christ. Oh, my God. I was talking to Kevin. We were talking about math. We're talking about math, right? I blamed math teachers. I'm 55 years old, right? I blamed math teachers for years, for my inability to count, you know? It was every dang inventory I used to take mathematics teachers. You've got to be kidding me, Joe. Yeah. And I'll never forget the time guy over there. I was really struggling trying to get a college degree because of mathematics. And I'll never forget, guy is an engineer, right? And I asked him for help. And I just must be a putz. I have no idea. But he came over to my house to help me, and he was like getting mad. You know, because like if you don't know it, you want to defend the fact that you don't know it and that... He turned into one of the math teachers. You know what I'm saying? No, I want to blame them. I want to blame everybody else for my seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That's just the way I am. I don't know why I brought that up. I haven't got a clue why I brought that up. Does anybody know where I was going with that? Math. Joy of living, Christmas. Thank you. So it was like really, really like my whole now for years was consumed with yesterday. I hope you can understand that. My whole now was consumed with yesterday. I could not enjoy this moment because it was so full of yesterday's moments. So full of yesterday's moments and so much afraid of tomorrow's. But so full of yesterday's moments. And until I really was able to get really in and do this inventory and like share my intimate, most darkest, deepest secrets, you know, with another human being and God, I was relieved and like I was right sized. The 12 and 12 calls that we get right sized. Get right, because my head is like, whoa, it's, as the big book says, the main problem with the alcoholic centers in his mind. Mind. Doesn't center it in his wallet, doesn't center it in his crotch, center it in his mind. I'm telling you, it's not what I want to believe. I don't want to believe that. And in my mind was a pong game. It was just never stuck. Black and white, too. It was like, bom, 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 bom. It was busy. It was really busy. And when I was able to clear that away with Eugene, and then he helped me go on with the 8th, 9th, and all the other 6th and 7th step, I think. For me, the 6th and 7th step are the ones that find where I find a balance in life. If you ain't finding balance, are you doing it wrong? I'd have no idea. But he explained it to me, Eugene. He said he was a big guy like this, and he goes, take your steps. He goes, lumber them out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, right? And he goes, look at 6 and 7. What's in between there? And he goes, that's the problem. And it was so literal. He said, that's the problem. He said, you need to find the balance of this thing right here, Joe. He said, your 6th step of the way you are coming in here, your 7th step is the way you're going to be when God gets you to that point. If you can just live in that thing, and that's like a fulcrum, it's like, you know, the old seesaw, whatever. You find that place where you find a balance and you just kind of live life and just kind of enjoy it. God dang, don't squander away the hours with petty resentments. For you don't understand. My resentments aren't really petty, Eugene. You know what I mean? And it's like, and then all of a sudden the sponsor becomes the delusion smasher, you know. Really kind of bring it down. Said, Joe, it's not really, you're not any different than anybody else. You're just scared, really. You're riddled with fear. Riddled with fear. Absolutely riddled with fear. And I was useless and I was no good. And it was just, I couldn't get work and it was just pathetic. And I was always just awful. And I was at a meeting and he goes, and that's what he said to me. He says, and by the way, Joe, you need a job. I can't do that. I've been trained to be a deep sea underwater diver. I have the ability to make hundreds and thousands of dollars a year. He goes, I don't care. You need a job. You don't understand. I do. Go to a meeting and tell somebody you need a job. So I went to a meeting one day and I whined about him telling me that I needed a job, and he told me to go to a meeting and tell you guys that I needed a job. And this woman sitting next to me says, I work for a clothing company downtown San Diego. They're hiring right now. It's actually a pretty good job. I says, but I have the ability to make a lot of money as an undersea diver. She says, well, if you can get the job, it's fine. But right now, they're hiring. So I went down and I became a salesman for International Mail, which was a men's underwear company. They sold thongs for men. All right. Now, I don't wear thongs. I've never, ever, ever worn a thong in my life. But it's pretty amazing how many people do, really. And I was a trained hard hat underwater deep sea diver. And I would start work at 5 o'clock in the morning, and these people would go, "Hey, Joe, your voice is very, very sexy." And I would turn to the person next to me. I says, "I think this guy's a pervert." And they said, "Most of them are, Joe." And she says, "Get his credit card and sell him a leather jacket and get the commission. You'll be good." So that's what I learned how to do. For 2.5 years, I sat on this stupid phone bank listening to people that liked my sexy voice and bought thongs, you know. It was hideous, hideous stuff, but it was exactly what I needed at the time. And I have to say that because my idea is $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 a year. My idea is that. Therefore, I will not do anything until I get that. Right? Virgo, or ergo, nothing came along. So Virgo, ergo, I don't know what it is. I'm trying to be profound. So 10 minutes? So I would just start, that's how I started doing it. And that's how I started to change. That's how I started to really kind of live, I guess in today, I don't, trust me, I hated the job. I absolutely hated the job. But it gave me the ability to pay bills. It gave me a little bit of self-esteem, a little, very little, trust me. But the one thing it gave me was 90% of the people that worked there were in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't like the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm newly sober. I did not like it, didn't like the people, didn't like anything to do with it. But what happened was God kept putting me in positions where I learned to like the fellowship. And I liked the fellowship, and then I got involved with the fellowship, and I got involved in the fellowship, and I have to say, short enough, so they got me involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The fellowship will walk away on me. It'll walk away on me. It really will get up and walk away. If that's what my stock in trade is, if that's what I've turned my will and life over to, that the fellowship, rather than the care of God as I understand God, and that program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think I got rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence by just getting involved in a fellowship and then into the program of AA. And it's never let me down. Really, the people have never let me down. Certain people have because I put some demands upon them or some expectations upon them that they just cannot meet. And I want to blame them for it. That's my job. My job is to find this emotional sobriety that is just like, you know, I'm responsible for my own misery. I manufacture most of it. I manufacture all of it, really. So I have to be responsible, but I want to blame you guys for it. And Cowboy Ralph out in Alpine years ago, he said he had to drop the word blame from his speech and thought. I remember him saying that at a meeting one night, and I said, "God dang, that's perfect. Drop the word blame from speech and thought." And I think I did that. I think I did that along the way, and I started to grow up in little bitty increments, little bitty increments. And this joy that Milt talked about is really just living right in the moment. When I was 8 years sober, I got really, really sick in AA, and I'm kind of a self-will run riot kind of guy, and I had quit my job. I had a pretty good job with a law firm at the time, and I quit the job, and I went back to selling underwear. I don't know why, because it was just, I have no idea why, but it was, and then I got really sick, and long story short, on my 8th year birthday, I was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS on my 8th birthday, and I didn't even know I was HIV positive. And it was an incredible shock to me, and yet at the same time an incredible moment at the same time, because it was just, I tell you, I was really, really isolated and alone in AA, and up until that moment in time I was. It was really, I remember I went over to the VA, I was over there, and the doctor said, "How long have you been HIV positive?" I said, "Doctor, I had no idea I was HIV positive." And they gave me the news over the phone. It was just really not what they're supposed to do. And it didn't make any difference to me because it was weird. I was 8 years sober, and I remember standing there like a boob. And I said, I kind of like took control for a minute, you know. I said, "Doc, I've been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 years. And they always talk about surrender. I have no idea what that word meant until this moment in time. I said, I will do anything you say to get better, because I don't want to, I want to live. And she says, it's going to be a really tough road. I was really sick at the time. And it really was a really tough road. And yet it was, what happened was I called Bus, who was my second sponsor, and I said, Bus, I got some bad news, I'm dying. And he said, you can't die, I got to give you a cake at the meeting on Friday night. I said, I can't do that, I'm dying. And he made me come to the meeting and take a cake. And it was my moment where I really believed being rocketed into the fourth dimension. Bill Wilson talks about the fourth dimension of existence. And the fourth dimension is right here and right now. It's right in the moment. It's right in the thick of the storms and all the illnesses. And it's like being able to live right in that moment. It has nothing to do with dying. It has nothing to do with living. It has to do with right back to that music, to that heartbeat. And that meeting on Friday night, it was North Park Men's on Friday night, really, I believe, picked me up because I was down. I was down physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And I saw the fellowship that I absolutely hated come to life before my eyes. Gave me a life before my eyes. The fellowship that I doubted, that I didn't like, that I absolutely hated, picked me up like that stupid footprints prayer. Picked me up and carried me. And it's like, and it's really, you know, it's really, there's things that are said, things that are done in AA that are so subtly beautiful that if you're living in resentment, you're going to miss it all. And I hope you don't live that way. I hope you find that peace is spelled P-E-A-C-E. I wasn't looking for P-E-A-C-E when I got here. I was looking for P-E-I-C-E. And the P-E-I-C-E will get up and walk away on you. It will get up and walk away on you. The P-E-A-C-E will get into your soul and into your heart and into your mind. And I believe rocket you into that fourth dimension of existence. And if that's not what you want, if you want something other than that, you're probably going to be disappointed with Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to be. You probably will be. And I that's kind of a reality for a lot of people, because I think a lot of times people come in here and they want a little bit more than what AA is going to give you. It's going to give you yourself. And I love being sober. It's very busy, my life. Very, very busy, my life. You know, my mom called me the other day. My mom just turned 94. And I remember talking to Ken about this last year. And he says, you know, she doesn't have much time left. And when your mom sends out the signal to come visit, my mom's in Boston. She was talking to me last week. She says, when are you coming to visit? With that tone in her voice, like, I need to see you. I said, I'll be there in a couple of weeks. I hadn't a plan to do it. And AA has taught, when AA says, can you, I usually say, yes, what do you want me to do? That's what I do now. When I got here, I was so full of contempt and so full of doubt that if you said, would you like to go to dinner? My head would say, I'm not having sex with you. It's the truth, because I always thought there was something behind the question. You know, and it's like, will you? And I said, yes, I will. So I'm going to go see mom next week. And she's like, I said, you know, and she's really, really old and hurting. And she wants to like cook and all. And I says, and don't do anything. She says, well, what are we going to do? I said, would you like to go to Costco for a hot dog? She said, I love Costco hot dogs. You know, and I tell my brothers, why don't you just take her to Costco? They don't get it. You know, my brother, who's the health nut, he goes, hot dogs are really bad for you. I go, for Christ's sake, she's 94 years old. You know, buy her some cigarettes, for Christ's sake. You know? But I think it's being, you know, AA has given me the ability to look and listen. Probably the biggest gift it's given me is to listen. You know, things are not said in AA. And what we as sponsors learn is how to pick up the things that are not said. You know what I'm saying? There's a lot of stuff not said. How many times you've been to a meeting and listened to a newcomer share, and you want them to get to the goddamn point? My job is to give them the time to get to the point. My job is not to say, get to my point. Get on my time. It's to give them the time to get to the point. That's why I love being sober. You know, that's why I love the ability to actually do these things for my family. And it isn't my family that have given, it's AA's, this family that has given me the ability to have a family and to have a life and to actually live a life that Milt calls the joy of living. It's a code. But it's a code that I have to take the action to get to. If I want to get from point A to point B, I have to take the action. I can't expect you guys to do it. So if you don't think this deal works, try it. Here's another good one. If you don't think God will help you, all you got to do is ask. Thanks. All right.